I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Missouri Republicans believe that the process for citizens to directly create and amend the state's laws is too easy. Now, Jefferson City lawmakers want to regulate the initiative petition procedure. Today, a look at initiative reform, what exactly the Republicans object to, whether a total overhaul is really needed, and to what extent are organizations resisting these proposals. Then, Sunday's game for the Chiefs has just about everybody talking. A former Chiefs player, a sports trainer, and a ticket broker all give us their perspectives on the game, and we want to hear from you. Call in and let us know your plans for watching the big game. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Republican lawmakers in Jefferson City are saying it's time to reform the way initiative petitions work in Missouri. That's the process whereby signatures get gathered across the state to change laws or even pass new ones. The complaint, it's too easy to pass changes to state laws and even the state constitution. This comes after voters passed a series of progressive ballot measures last year that included a raise to the minimum wage, ethics reform, the legalization of medical marijuana, and a rejection of anti-union legislation. With us to talk about this GOP proposal is State Representative Dan Stacey. He's from Blue Springs. And Representative, nice to have you. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Appreciate you having me.
I should point out that I'm a member of the STARS editorial board, and we've said that this process needs a tweak, not a big overhaul. Representative, why do you think this initiative process needs to be changed?
Well, I would say our right to petition our government for change to pass the General Assembly, bypass the General Assembly and the signature of the governor is currently spelled out in our Missouri Constitution.
Right.
I would say also that direct democracy is meant to give citizens a means to mount a grassroots effort to effect change. And I wholeheartedly support grassroots involvement in the process of government.
But, so there's a place for it, you're
saying.
Yeah,
sure. But when we look at what's happening here in Missouri and in other states, we have to realize that this process has become a means for special interest groups from outside the state to spend millions of dollars that affect the way Missourians operate and the way Missouri families live their lives. And when you look at, for instance, the Clean Missouri Initiative, you see that more than $1 million in dark money flowed into the state to support it. Liberal donors in Texas gave Clean Missouri $825,000. Elites in Washington, D.C. sent another $250,000. The groups took $50,000 from Planned Parenthood and from Kansas,
$35,000. In all kinds of races, and up and down the ballot these days, has become part of our political system.
And certainly, I think a part of what happened with Clean Missouri is a way in which the current process for things being transparent have been circumvented. And so I think that is a challenge we have here in Missouri.
Well, is the challenge, do you think, even greater? Do we need an overhaul of our campaign finance system so we have a clearer sense of who these dark money donors are? Because that proposal has been put forward.
Well, let's talk a bit about the idea of making changes, first of all, even to our Constitution, and whether that should be a frequent or rare thing. I'm of the opinion that our Constitution is the document that should guide us as we legislate. We shouldn't be legislating through our Constitution. It was James Madison who was opposed to the idea of too frequently changing our Constitution. When talking about frequent changes, Madison said that said they would in great measure deprive the government of the veneration without which perhaps the wisest and freest government would not possess the requisite stability. And when we look at our United States,
so it's too easy to change the state constitution. You're saying,
well, certainly. And when we look at the United States Constitution, we see that there in fact rarely changes are made there. At last, our last amendment to the United States Constitution, the 27th Amendment, was ratified in 1992, the 26th Amendment was ratified in 1971. So that's two changes of our country's Constitution in the last 5 decades. Here in Missouri, we saw 3 changes to our Missouri Constitution in November.
Wow. You know, it's hard not to conclude, Representative, that Republicans want to do this because voters have been adopting all these progressive measures like raising the minimum wage or passing this major ethics reform package. What about that part of it?
Well, sure, I appreciate that. Many times people point to California as a prime example for the initiative petition process spiraling out of control. On their November ballot, California residents had 11 ballot initiatives to consider, and in 2016 they had 17. For some contrast, only 9 initiatives reached the state ballot in California in the entire decade of the 60s.
But what about this idea that you guys are pushing for this because measures the voters are approving are progressive in nature and sort of against some of the ethos of the Republican Party?
Well, in California, one of the legislators leading the charge for reform is Assemblyman Evan Lowe, who is a Democrat. Assemblyman Lowe actually had a quote I thought was very telling about the initiative petition process. He said, "The average citizen that I interact with," he says, "asks, why aren't you doing your job? Why are you continually asking us to go through the voter guides that were longer than," he says, "the Great Gatsby in the last election cycle?" This is an important point to make and understand, because when you make changes to the Constitution or statute, you're asking voters to digest a great deal of information in a very short time.
And some might be said of state lawmakers. I mean, the argument here is that lawmakers aren't representing the will of the people if they're not putting into law some of these changes that Missourians apparently want to see put in place.
Well, certainly. But our November ballot had over 100 pages of statute language to digest to support the couple of pages that were represented on the ballot. I've asked many people if they read all 100 pages of statute language and before they voted, and I have yet to find anyone in Jackson County who said yes.
Well, state lawmakers oftentimes don't read the entire bill either, Representative, and they vote on those things all the time.
Well, certainly, many of us found consternation toward one of our federal government officials when she said, "We have to pass the bill so that we can find out what's in it." That's no way for anyone to make law. We should not be creating a process that our citizens are forced to exercise this way of making law.
Do other states do it in a way that you admire? Is there a model out there that you would prefer to see?
Well, I'd just say that the Missouri Secretary of State has pointed to differences between the 2008 and the 2018 election cycle and why many of the current changes are needed. In 2008 cycle, there were 55 initiative petitions filed, 25 were approved for circulation, and 3 were on the ballot. 2018
And that would argue that it's very difficult to get these things on the ballot, which is what Sean Nicholson, who headed the Clean Missouri Initiative, he's going to be in here in a few minutes. He's going to make that point very clearly, I bet you.
Well, I'm sure he will, but the fact is, in 2018, there were 371 initiative petitions filed, 148 were approved for circulation, and 5 made it onto the ballot. Specifically looking at initiative petitions, one Missourian filed 60 petitions, another filed 57 petitions, and another filed 30 petitions, and all 32 different Missourians filed 371 initiative petitions, which received by the Secretary's office.
Well, maybe the issue then is on the front end of this process and ensuring that so many of these petitions then don't get filed to begin with, maybe putting a small fee on the front end of the process to discourage just the willy-nilly turning in of ideas here.
Well, certainly. And if a special interest wants to make a change to our Constitution, Why would you compromise or navigate change the legislative process when you can get everything? Or why would you go through the legislative process when you can get everything you want from the voters from oversimplifying the issue with a 30-second spot?
Yeah, but frankly, that's not true, though.
What's happening now is not a grassroots effort primarily. It's special interest with large out-of-state donor money. At some level, changing the way in which Missourians do their lives.
You know, Representative, you know, Missourians had argued for years, had clamored for years for cleaner ethics laws in this state. And the General Assembly didn't pass them, even though your House of Representatives any number of times, maybe even with your support, voted for gift bans and the like. The state Senate didn't take it up, and it was only left to the voters to decide because the legislature wouldn't do it.
Well, that's a claim that we haven't
done
it, but we certainly have. We want things to be transparent, and we want what we had in the past. Any money that was given to a legislator was gone through the Missouri Ethics Commission and was reported to them, and the voters could go to that and see where people spent their money. Today, we've got a process that encourages dark money, encourages it not to go through the regular order and be reported. It has what Clean Missouri has done is encourage money not to go through that channel and go outside of that channel where people can't really see it. And I frankly, I don't think that's what Missourians wanted.
Are Republicans now inclined to pass legislation that would prohibit dark money in Missouri and require that anonymous donors be revealed?
Well, I certainly can't speak for all of the legislators, but I certainly would prefer that all money that was given was money that was transparent and that people could see, and that at the end of the day, voters can find their own right and wrong in any of these issues.
What are the chances, Representative, that something gets done on initiative reform this session, a reform of it? What do you anticipate happening here?
Well, I tell you, I'm not going to speak for others, and but we all are working to find the best possible outcomes for our citizens of the state of Missouri.
That's Representative Dan Stacey. He's a Blue Springs Republican. He wants to reform the initiative process in Missouri. Representative, thanks for taking some time with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And now we're joined here for a different view by Sean Nicholson. He was the campaign director for the Clean Missouri Ethics Initiative that passed easily in Missouri in November. Sean, welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Steve.
What do you make of Republican efforts to make initiatives tougher to pass in Missouri? Representative Stacey just outlined his views here.
Yeah, I think it reminds me of why we have the initiative process in general. So it is really hard to get initiative petitions on the ballot. It takes hundreds of thousands of signatures. It takes months. It takes years of work. And that only happens when the legislature is not being responsive to what the voters are demanding. Not only does it take a lot of time and effort to get a measure on the ballot, but then you got to go make your case. And we saw just here in November, there were three measures that came from voters that were passed, but then there were two that were rejected. So voters take their jobs very seriously. It's hard to pass ballot measures beyond just some of those logistical hurdles, because if voters are confused, if they think they're getting the wool pulled over their eyes, they're going to vote no, and they're going to reject those measures.
Remind us what the requirements are, Sean, to get an initiative on the ballot. I think you have to gather signatures equal to a certain percentage of statewide votes from six of the eight congressional districts across the state.
That's right. So you have to get signatures in three-quarters of the congressional districts. So that's six right now in Missouri. And you have to – it depends on how many voters – cast their ballots in the last gubernatorial election. So for constitutional amendments, you've got to get 8% of the last gubernatorial vote count. For statutory measures like the minimum wage piece that just passed, it's 6% of the last count.
So it's harder then to get a constitutional amendment petition on the ballot compared to just a regular state law.
That's right. So there are logistical challenges. It takes more signatures on the front end. So you got to start earlier or, get more signatures on the front end. And then the other thing that we know from research both in Missouri and across the country is that voters take their job, I mean, they think about it hard and they do their research. And if you're trying to change the Constitution, it's a higher bar that you got to pass. So, you know, if you look at a poll and you say we want to do statutory versus constitutional, you know, you got to get 4 or 5% more support to get that measure into the Constitution.
Clean Missouri was a constitutional change, right?
That's right.
Tell us how difficult it was for you guys. How many signatures did you need? How long did it take you? And give us some sense of what it cost.
Yeah, so we turned in 340,000 signatures. It took more than a year to collect those. And then, you know, we started the collection probably, I'm trying to remember now, April or May of 2017 and continued through May of 2018. And that takes, I think that it took about $1.5 million to raise that. It was a combination of investments from organizations plus individual donors to help make that happen. And, you know, it's hard to do. And yeah, it takes a lot of time.
A lot of time and a lot of money.
Yep.
You decided to do this because why? I mean, obviously, as I mentioned to Representative Stacey, ethics reform had been a subject for a lot of years. Nothing passed the General Assembly, and then you guys came along. Was it because the General Assembly hadn't acted?
Yeah, I mean, I think on almost everything that passed this in November, the legislature had opportunities to act and then chose not to. So whether it's shutting down lobbyist gifts or reducing the influence of politics on the redistricting process, there's a lot of things the legislature could have done to make those things happen and just chose not to. Voters have been demanding raises in the minimum wage for a while, chose not to act, and citizens said, enough, we're gonna actually force the ball here.
How are you guys responding to Republican efforts now to make it tougher to pass these things? Is your group going to engage in this debate?
Yeah, I think there are going to be a lot of folks from across the political spectrum who recognize the importance of preserving this as an option for citizens to take action. So I think there'll be pushback. I also think it's important that we're able to separate a lot of the different issues that are coming up. I mean, that even came up in the first part of the conversation today, right? So there's stuff on the front end. Like, it is 200 initiative petitions that get filed. That is a lot, 300. Some of those are not serious from jump, and that's obvious.
Just the statements being made.
Yeah, the statements being made, or folks are shopping for language. You know, so, you know, there are administrative things that could happen there.
You could charge people a fee to file a petition, a request for a petition, which might slow this train down a little bit.
Yeah, so I think there are state resources that are required to handle those. And so, like, that's one bucket of conversations. I think it's something totally different to be creating hurdles that are intended to make it impossible or very difficult for citizens to take action.
Do you have any sense, Sean, is it easier or tougher in Missouri to pass state law changes and constitutional changes via the initiative petition route?
So it's already relatively difficult in Missouri to do this. So, for instance, in some states, there's no geographic requirement at all for how signatures are collected. So a campaign can really run up the score in an urban area, and then they don't really have to go make their case in rural or suburban areas. That's not the case right now in Missouri. You've got, as we mentioned, you got to go in 6 districts. And so that requires doing the work, not just in Kansas City and St. Louis, but you got to go make your case in Joplin and Springfield,
right,
in Columbia, northern Missouri, southeast Missouri.
So this effort then by Republicans to make this process tougher, is it sour grapes? Is that what this is, in your view?
So there's probably an element to that with some of the proposals. I think some of the measures and some of the questions about reducing the administrative strain, I think those are well-intentioned, and I think some of those are reasonable. I think some of them that are trying to eliminate the process are about politicians, once again, thinking they know better than voters.
Again, Governor Parson, a Republican, is behind this. Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft, a Republican, seems to be behind this as well. How serious of a threat is this to the process as you sit here today?
So I do think it's serious. I also think that it is easy to talk big in December and January. It becomes harder if you're trying to amend we have constitutional rights to petition our government and make things happen. So I think it's a much different case once you have to actually go to voters. I think there's a certain irony to that from the folks who are talking about how easy it is perhaps to pass initiative petitions. It's really hard to pass ballot measures. Voters take their jobs very seriously. You got to make your case over a long period of time. It's not something that sneaks up on anybody. So it's a real challenge, and those safeguards and those checks and balances are really important.
Sean Nicholson, who spearheaded the Clean Missouri Ethics Petition Drive in Missouri, is my guest. While I have you here, there's also a push on to undo some of the provisions of Clean Missouri. One big one is the most controversial aspect of this new law, Sean, which has to do with the way legislative districts get drawn every 10 years after the census gets done. What do you make of this effort?
So I think this is. I think there are some legislators in Jefferson City who are misinformed and have been intentionally misinformed by folks who have preferred the old way of doing business. I think some of that can be rectified. I think some of it is also sour grapes, as you mentioned before. The great news for Missourians, you know, we passed by a 2-1 margin. Reforms that had bipartisan support, that are transparent, that are clear to make sure that everybody gets a fair shake. And so that big coalition that got Amendment 1 passed continues to work to this day. The other great thing is that transparency and fairness and competition, those are the laws of the land right now. And so any sort of effort to roll those back in order to provide some sort of particular special group or a party some sort of special break, I mean, they're going to have a hard time making that case.
How difficult is it to engage average citizens in a process argument like this? Are Missourians aware, are the rank-and-file Missourians aware of what's going on here? Are you trying to gin up interest, or how are you approaching it?
Yeah, so we're continuing the campaign work that we've been doing for more than 2 years now. So we started having conversations about all the parts of what became Amendment 1 more than 2 years ago, from the redistricting portions to the lobbyist gift portions to the open government sunshine law provisions that are also under attack right now in Jefferson City. So there's been – folks know a whole lot more about gerrymandering than they did 2.5 years ago, in large part because of a lot of federal lawsuits that have gone up to the Supreme Court. There's been a lot more conversation from both parties on the right way to do this and reforms that can happen.
In another change the Republicans are looking at here, the House has passed rules that affect which records are public and which are not. Again, your Clean Missouri initiative dealt directly with this, requiring that lawmaker records now be public. The new policy deals with lawmakers' documents on party strategy and correspondence with constituents. Those can be kept private, the House is saying. What do you make of that change?
So I think there's been a fair amount of misdirection from politicians in Jefferson City who are really not excited about having to follow the same open records laws that everyone else in state government has to follow, from the governor down to the mayor and city council. All Amendment 1 says is the House and Senate need to follow the generally applicable open records laws that apply to everyone else. So that governs the records that have to be disclosed, but also what kinds of information can be redacted or held back. So, of course, personally identifiable information about health records or Social Security numbers, the State Department of Health has got those records, but of course those should not be subject to disclosure. So what I think is happening right now is that there are folks in the legislature who are using those concerns and misdirection as a way to create some new blanket secrecy rules so that they can keep information that conversations they'd really rather not make public about conversations with big donors, lobbyists, things like that. It's going to be an adjustment for a lot of folks to start being more open and transparent, and I think this is an overreaction and a really unfortunate one in the House.
Sean, help me understand this, because I'm surprised that the House can pass internal rules that contradict a voter-approved change in the state constitution. I didn't know you could do that.
I don't know that they can either. So, I mean, I think there's going to be
a legal challenge, perhaps.
I think the way the Sunshine Law works is that any citizen can make a request, and if it's denied, then there are – we all have recourse in – we can complain to the attorney general. We can go to court. The courts have been very much on the side of citizens and not on public officials in terms of transparency and making things public. So it wouldn't shock me if there's a legal challenge on that. But, you know, we're only – 2 to 3 days into this policy, so we'll see how things go.
We'll see how things go. That's Sean Nicholson, again, campaign director for the Clean Missouri Ethics Initiative that passed in Missouri last November. Sean, appreciate you coming in. Thanks for sharing your views. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll ask you, where are you going to be at 5:30 on Sunday afternoon for this big Chiefs championship football game? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, as the CBD industry takes off in Kansas City, we talked about what regulations are in place to keep consumers safe and where CBD falls in the legal spectrum. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Monday, Up to Date will be off for Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Tune in for special programming. We'll return on Tuesday. Well, what will you be doing about 5:30 Sunday afternoon? Chances are you'll be gearing up to watch our Chiefs in what will be the first time that Arrowhead Stadium is to host an AFC Championship game. That seems as odd to say it as it is true. This town is on fire. We want to know the best place in this city to watch this game. Is it at home? Is it at Arrowhead? Freezing temperatures and all? Is it your friendly neighborhood tavern? Give us a call, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Where's the best place to watch a huge game like this? 816-235-2888. Producer Danny Alexander has lined up some terrific guests here to talk about this one. We hopefully will be visiting with former Chiefs lineman Tim Grunhard, who knows something about playing in cold weather. We'll talk to a sports medicine expert about what playing in conditions like this does to the body and how you can dress if you're going to be out there. Finally, we'll talk to a ticket broker about the market for this game on Sunday. First up, I hope we don't have Tim Grunhard yet. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I'm joined now by Doug Weissner. He's the Sports Medicine Program Director for the University of Kansas Health System. Doug, are you there? We hope to have Doug Weissner here in just a moment. He's the Sports Medicine Program Director for the University of Kansas Health System. Doug, are you on the line?
I am on the line.
I'm glad you're there. How are you?
I am doing well, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. And are you going to the game on Sunday?
I do. I am going to the game. I have to work the game.
What are you going to be doing?
I am a NFL spotter, so I'll be looking after injuries and things like that.
What does that mean? Like, what does that job entail?
Well, I'm going to watch the game and basically call down to the sideline if I see something.
And what might that be?
You know, Steve, I'd love to tell you that, but without the NFL saying that I can do that would be that'd probably get me into a little bit of trouble. So I appreciate the question, but I really. You know, obviously the NFL is trying to protect their players, and that's what I'm up there doing.
Could this be related, Doug, to concussions? And I won't go any further in that, but is that part of the
yes.
menu of things you might be looking after here?
Yes.
Okay. Now, it doesn't make any sense to me that thousands of people and pro football players are going to be standing outside for hours on Sunday in what's going to be very cold conditions. What's the biggest threat to fan and athlete alike when it comes to playing in conditions like this?
For the fan, it's going to be frostbite and hypothermia. They're going to be out there for extended period of times. You know, you're a fan, I'm a fan, we're all fans. And so there's alcohol that's going to be consumed. And once that starts getting into your system, sometimes we don't make the best judgments that we should.
And what might people do that would be against their better judgment?
Take their clothes off.
Okay.
I mean, how many times have you seen a football game and it's frigid temperatures and there's those two people sitting in the front row and they have one on one chest and five on the other chest and you're going, okay,
yeah,
this is not going to be a good outcome.
Well, I was going to say, you see these big linemen, and they're oftentimes linemen as opposed to wide receivers, oftentimes not covering up their arms, even on the coldest days. What do you make of that? They're not setting a very good example for the rest of us, are they?
No, they're not. But, you know, a football player versus a fan is different. A football player's out there playing. Their adrenaline is running. Not that the fans won't have adrenaline running, but their adrenaline is moving. They're out there playing. They're in motion. They're sweating. Their core temperature's up. Their body temperature's up. And then when they run off the field, what do? They put on a $500 Gore-Tex down jacket that keeps them warm.
Mm-hmm. What else is a threat for players and fans on Sunday, Doug?
Well, for the players, it's going to be cold out there. And so when they get hit, it's going to sting and it's not going to feel good. You know,
and that's different than what it normally might be in warm weather conditions?
Yeah, it's no, you can still get stingers and get hit the right way, but the propensity for it is a little bit more in this cold weather. You know, being all of 5'5" and about 150 pounds, I never played the sport. And so firsthand knowledge, I can't tell you that. But, you know, from seeing hundreds to thousands of football games from the professional level all the way down to the youth level, when it's cold outside, those football players get hurt, hit the right way. It stings and it hurts.
Is it possible to get injured? Is it more likely to become injured in a cold weather situation than in a warmer weather?
It takes a little bit more to stay loose in a cold weather environment. But your football players know that, and they should be reacting to that and staying loose on the sidelines.
Yeah.
It's a mentality of, you know, I can't, it's not 90 degrees outside. You know, the body temperature is going to stay warm. My muscles are going to stay warm. There's still a warm-up period during that time. But when it's 10 degrees, 20 degrees outside, you're going to have to be a little bit more active about that.
We're asking our listeners to chime in and answer this question. Where are you going to be on Sunday? Where's the best place to watch this AFC Championship game? 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Sherwood tweeted us this: I'll be having Tom Brady's retirement party. Maybe it's at his place. Sherwood, let us know where that's going to be. I'll be curious. So, Doug, what's the best way then to stay warm on a day like this, particularly if you're a player and you're sweating, you're coming on and off the field, you have to go off the field, you wait a while until it's your turn to play again? How hard is that on the body?
Well, there's some difficulty to that, but also look at your sideline. That sideline is going to have these massive hot air blowers out there. The benches are going to be warmed. The little posts that the football players put their helmets on, those are heated, so they're not putting a cold helmet on and ripping their ears off. At least they'll only do that once, and then they'll put their helmets on that post. And plus, you know, it's the NFL. They've got all the gear in the world to stay warm. That doesn't mean that they stay warm, because they're sweating. And so that sweat gets cold. So they're going to have to put that jacket on and get in front of that blower to stay warm. It can be done. And then, you know, versus the fans, football players get to go in for halftime. And they can take those cold clothes off, undergarments off, put dry stuff back on, and come out feeling fresh in the second half.
So what do you recommend then, Doug, for fans and the best way to stay warm?
What'd mom tell you to do?
She
told you to layer up, right?
Right.
Absolutely, layer up. Get your wool socks out. Get your winter boots out. Get your hand and toe warmers in. Get your flannel-lined jeans on. Put on layers around, you know, your core. Put on that down jacket if you have it. Put the scarf on. Put the wool headgear on. And go have some fun. I mean, The fans will be active enough. The thing to caution is not too many of those down and outs in the parking lot to where all of a sudden you start sweating and now you got to go sit and now you're in that cold t-shirt that didn't wick the moisture away from your body. So, you know, a couple of down and outs between the Ford and the Chevy, that's okay. But let's not get too many of those things going so that we have a full-blown sweat going on.
Is it really true that most of your body heat goes out through your head, Doug?
No.
Oh, really?
Studies have found that, you know, it used to be 90%. Studies have found that about 10% of your body heat goes out of your head.
Who's going to win on Sunday?
The Chiefs are going to win. You don't even need to ask me that question. This is going to be like 14 and 15 with the Royals. It's going to be 18 to 19 for the Kansas City Chiefs. So it's not even a question.
And where are you going to be sitting on Sunday? Do they give you a special place, given your position, keeping an eye on these players?
I'll be on the ninth floor. I'll be nice and warm, hopefully.
Oh, I see. So you watch from up there.
Yeah, I watch from up there.
I see.
Yeah.
That's Doug Weissner, a sports medicine program director for the University of Kansas Health System. Doug, I sure appreciate you taking some time. Have a good time on Sunday.
Okay. Thanks for having me,
Steve. You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the big Chiefs game on Sunday. Where are you going to watch it? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Brad from Rhode Island. Rhode Island? Are you really out in Rhode Island, Brad?
Yeah. All the way out on the road. Yeah. Native Kansas City guy, but I'm out here and have been for a few years. I will be watching deep behind enemy territory out here in New England, but I'm watching with a bunch of my friends who, unfortunately, are all Patriots fans.
They just don't get it, do they? You have to explain the realities of life to them a little bit.
Well, yeah, and they think New England cold is different than Midwestern cold, and that's going to keep the Chiefs fans quiet, and that Arrowhead's going to be muted. And they're misinformed.
Boy,
are they
ever misinformed? Well, let's find out. Brad, I'm glad you called. Let's find out how misinformed they are. I want to bring in someone I've admired from afar for many years, and that's Tim Grunhard, the former Chiefs offensive lineman who played college football at Notre Dame, where he won a national championship. He's coached Bishop Miege, not far from my house, where he had great success and won a state championship. Tim, thanks for taking some time with us today. I appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. We're very, very excited here in the kingdom about the big game coming up on Sunday, and it's great to be on with you guys.
So what do you have to say to those New England fans? We just heard from a caller who's saying that those folks out here think it's going to be so cold that Chiefs fans are going to be pretty quiet on Sunday. What's been your experience, Tim?
I think it's just wishful thinking on their part. I think that's what they're hoping for. I know Kansas City Chiefs fans, and I've played in a lot of very, very cold games that when the other offense is on the field, that there's no way they could hear. So I'm very optimistic about the noise level at Arrowhead, and I think it's going to be just fine for the Kansas City Chiefs.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to lock you in, Tim, and make sure you're there. I want to bring in someone else here, Dave Hale from Ottawa, Kansas, who used to play for the Bears. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Dave. Tell me how cold it can get out at Arrowhead, Dave.
Well, I know it can get cold. Coldest I've ever been in my life was in Minnesota for our game up there in 1970. And I don't know what the rules are right now, but we put tape over our ear holes, and so you couldn't even hear the signals called, let alone the muffled cheers of the fans. It was hilarious. I was freezing. It was unbelievable.
Tim, that was the old days. You didn't put tape over your ear holes, did you, Tim?
No, but that's a pretty good idea. We probably should have done that. they had the kind of neoprene head sleeve kind of hats that you could put underneath when we were playing. And, you know, a day like you can attest to this, but as soon as the game starts and that adrenaline gets going and you're on the field, you know, you start to warm up a little bit. And, you know, I was one of those idiot offensive linemen that decided I'll never wear long sleeves when I went out and played. And we played against the Colts in 1986, and it was about 8 degrees or 7 degrees. And, we were doing pretty good by that time when we got out on the field.
Tim, why do you guys do that, not wear long sleeves? Is it a macho thing, or it just looks like it's really cold to do something like that?
You know what? There's a couple reasons. Number one, it's a macho thing. but number two, as Dave can attest to this, is, you know, you don't want to give those defensive linemen anything else to grab on. So, yeah, you know, if you have a T-shirt on or a long-sleeve shirt, they can grab and kind of get you off of balance with a tug or a pull, then you kind of fight against yourself. So we like to just kind of keep the arms clear so that the only thing they grab is skin, and hopefully they don't get to that.
Dave, how much tougher is it to play when it gets that cold out in the field?
Well, your hands freeze up. You can't grab anything, whether it's the quarterback or the receivers or even the linemen trying to grab and get some leverage on the offensive guys like Tim. You know, I was just recently, what, last week or so, Bob Kuchenberg died down in Miami.
Sure.
And his brother, Rudy, was also a Notre Dame athlete, and he was a reserve linebacker for us. And I remember Rudy lost his two middle front teeth, and he was called signal that day up in Minnesota. We couldn't understand him, let alone hear him. I remember one guy said, "What did he call?" And the other guy said, "I have no idea." It was just hilarious.
Tim, can you play as well when it's that cold outside?
Well, I think it's an advantage for the Patriots if it was going to be as cold as they said it was going to be, because I think a lot of the fast guys, you know, the Tyreek Hills and the Travis Kelce's and the Sammy Watkins of the world, they like it to be a little bit warmer, and so they're a little bit looser and they're not as tight with the muscles. They can't stretch out as well as they can in the heat. So I think that would certainly be an advantage if it was 5 or 6 degrees for the Patriots. I think the Kansas City Chiefs are more athletic than the Patriots. The Patriots are very well coached. They're very good fundamentally, but the Kansas City Chiefs are very fast and very athletic. So, yeah, that would have certainly affected the offense of the Kansas City Chiefs if it got as cold as it said it was going to get. But, you know, every day you're hearing it's getting a little bit warmer.
I was going to say, it's going to be in the 20s now, which really, does that put it in a different category, Dave Hale, as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, it does. There's cold, and then there's unbelievable. And I, when a guy comes in the regular rhythm of playing, he's not going to get cold. But if he gets benched or injured or whatever, and he cools off significantly after, you know, 15, 20 minutes or longer, he's going to have to warm up all over again. And then you're at a risk of pulling something or hurting yourself even worse. So.
Yeah, yeah. Playing as a lineman when it's cold, does that change the way you play the game, Tim?
Well, it certainly does hurt a little bit more when you're punching hard plastic
with
your hands.
Yeah.
So that does. But, you know, these days, Dave, and you know, you see these guys now, they have heated benches and they put their helmets on these heated poles and they have those heated blowers out there. And you know, I know that there are some different creams and some different ointments that guys can put on to stay warm. Now, obviously, not all that's going to work when it gets as cold as they were predicting. But, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit different now. Even now, when I, you know, 20 years ago when I was playing, David, I know back when you were playing that they didn't have all those fancy things going on. But, yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of things technology-wise and these equipment guys and these trainers can implement to help against the cold. So, yeah, as an offensive lineman, you know, anytime you're hitting somebody with a hard plastic on your head, and you're hitting hard plastic with your hands, it certainly does hurt.
Tim, where are you going to watch the game, Tim?
I'll be up in the club level. I'll be sitting outside, but I do have the opportunity to go inside and warm up. So I'm acting like a tough guy by saying I'm going to sit outside and brave the elements, but I can walk up about 20 feet and get inside. So that's not too bad.
When it comes to games like this, do you miss playing, or have you had enough, Tim?
You know what? You miss the paychecks more than anything else. But
I get that.
As Dave can attest, I don't miss waking up on Monday mornings and feeling all the aches and pains. Yeah, but you know what? To answer your question, the AFC Championship, that's something that generations of Kansas City Chiefs players would love to have played at Arrowhead Stadium. And these guys have an opportunity, and we're very excited for them. And really, we're excited for the fans. This is something the Kansas City Chiefs fans have deserved for many, many years, and it's here for them. And I contest also that the AFC Championship, the NFC Championship games are for the fans. The Super Bowl is for the corporations and the companies.
Right.
If you sell enough computers, you get to go to the Super Bowl with your company as a company
right.
visit. But these AFC and NFC Championships, that's what it's all about for the fans.
Tim Grunhard, thanks for taking some time with us. I sure appreciate it. Dave, I'm going to have to let you go. I sure appreciate you guys calling in today. Okay.
Have a good day.
You bet. Bye-bye. Now we're joined by Jason Durbin. He's Vice President of Ticket Operations for Tickets for Less. He joins us via Skype here this morning. Jason, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So what's the market been for this AFC Championship game in Kansas City on Sunday?
I mean, this game's been the biggest game that I've ever seen for the Chiefs. you know, there was a little bit of a lull where people were trying to decide when, you know, they were predicting it to be the coldest game ever. But now that we've kind of got past that, I mean, these past couple of days, I've never seen the phones and the website traffic. I've never seen it like this, not even during the World Series. So it's a huge game.
Well, let me just read a couple of tweets we got from listeners. We're asking where people are going to be watching the game. Ilex tweeted, in front of the fireplace at my friend Deb's cozy home with our sisters and a delicious potluck and Boulevard beer or some red wine or maybe both. KC Sportsgale on Twitter writes, at Arrowhead, can't wait. A lot of folks can't wait here. So what are the lower level bowl seats going for, Jason, for Sunday's game?
Well, I mean, lower level, you know, they're over $300 tickets right now. So which, you know, as far as AFC championship goes, is still a really good deal. You know, we're still a small market, so it's not like, you know, a game, you know, in New Orleans or something like that. So we still have some really good deals left, but they are starting to go fast, and it's a very popular game. So
as the temperature goes up, do the prices of the tickets go up, Jason? Does it work that way as the forecast begins to change?
I've seen a slow uptick so far in the last, you know, 24, 48 hours since the weather's really started making a turn. So, you know, if they keep calling for some good weather like this, I mean, as far as what's going right now, I mean, that's about as good a weather as you can ask for in a January, you know, playoff game outdoors. It's going to be perfect for the football game. And you can really tell people are really going to be turning out for it. It's going to be a raucous crowd.
What's the most expensive ticket in the Kansas City area right now? Is it the Chiefs game? Is it a concert? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, this Chiefs game is, you know, definitely the biggest hot ticket right now, and it's got some of the biggest prices. It's got the, you know, those club level tickets, or especially with the cold weather, people are really excited to try and steal a few minutes in the club level and warm up in between, you know, quarters, halftime.
What do those tickets go for?
Those tickets have gone for over $1,000. So
No kidding.
It's a hot ticket, and you know, but people are paying for the warmth.
Elton John's a hot ticket too, and so is Hamilton, right? The musical that's coming to town.
Yeah, Hamilton's huge. I mean, it's you know, that's the hot Broadway show right now. It's coming to Kansas City for the first time. You know, it's cheaper to see Hamilton in Chicago and New York right now than it is to see it in Kansas City, but it's that first time coming through, and people are really excited for it.
Just real quickly, can you get me a 50-yard line seat to the Chiefs game on Sunday, 15 rows back? Is that seat gettable?
That's the ideal seat. You know, you got just high enough so you can see the whole field. And,
right.
But those seats usually go pretty quick. Yeah. I don't know if we really have much of those left, because those are the type of unique seats that people you really snatch up right when the game, like that was last weekend.
Right.
The front row seats, you know, front row upper levels, those midfield seats, those are the ones that usually go the fastest, because those are the people that don't care about the weather.
That's Jason Durbin. He's with Tickets for Less and joined us via Skype. Jason, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
We're off on Monday because of Martin Luther King Day. We'll be back on Tuesday with another mayoral candidate interview, this time with Kansas City 3rd District Councilman Jermaine Reed. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Chris Pruitt, Steven Steigman, the Kansas News Service, Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Liz Ruiz. Go Chiefs! Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you next week.